Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to Solving the Puzzle with Dr. Datis Karazian, informing you about evidence-based strategies for autoimmune disease, brain health issues, Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, gut health problems, and many other chronic health conditions. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find more information on today's episode and other topics at drknews.com.
When you look at indirect endocrine disrupting chemicals, they impact us throughout the entire lifespan. They even impact preconception, health and fertility, and outcomes during pregnancy can have an impact on children. You look at endocrine dysfunction, endocrine disruptors, they've been shown to impact things like IQ and asthma and obesity, early puberty, thyroid dysfunctions, breast cancer, all types of hormone imbalance conditions, so forth. When you look at endocrine disrupting chemicals, one of the things that can happen is competitive binding of hormones. Endocrine disrupting binds to hormone receptors and competes with hormones for binding opportunities. So this can get in the way of hormones having an effect on tissue. So these disruptive chemicals can bind to these tissues and not allow normal, healthy hormones to have their function. Now, this can also take place not just from endocrine disrupting chemicals, but if you have an impaired hepatic biotransformation pathway and hormones are partially metabolized, you can have structures of hormones that can still bind to the receptor but don't have the same effect and then compete with actual hormones. So this competitive hormone mechanism not only happens with endocrine disrupting chemicals, but also happens with hormones that are normally metabolized through biotransformation pathways. If the biotransformation pathways are inefficient and the hormones are only partially metabolized and the hormone still has the ability to bind to receptors and compete, you can have enhanced cellular responses. Sometimes these hormones that compete with binding sites actually have structures that stimulate greater activity. In this scenario, you have a hormone binding to the receptor site and you're having exaggerated responses. Just because a hormone can bind to the receptor site doesn't mean to have one effect or the other. It really depends upon many variables, but sometimes the hormone that binds to the receptor site causes no effect and just competes. And other times the endocrine disrupting chemical binds to the hormone receptor and has exaggerated effects. And then they reduce cellular responses. So sometimes it just diminishes the response altogether, has an inhibitory effect. Endocrine disrupting chemicals generate weak cellular responses compared to hormones. So those are the different features of endocrine disrupting chemicals. And it's not very clear. For example, BPA always does this. It doesn't always do anything. For some people, BPA can stimulate the estrogenic effect and cause more estrogenic activity. For other people, BPA, like BPA bisphenol A in plastics, can decrease the estrogenic effect. So there's lots of variables between what the actual cellular response is between the binding and the effect that's so different that we don't have a very clear understanding if it's enhancing or stimulating, and it may even do both at different times with different physiological environments, but we do know that this disrupting chemical model is there. This is a paper that was really showing there's a lot of diverse effects on endocrine disrupting chemicals that take place at the DNA genetic level. And in this paper, they were very specific to male reproductive pathways, but it's similar for female reproductive pathways. And here they look at P, which are phytates, typically found in plastic products. And what they found here is that these phytate products were blocking binding sites on DNAs and coactivators that are needed for transcriptional steroid-producing genes over here. So it actually is impacting these DNA receptor binding site responses. BPA is binding to the estrogen receptor site here, and it's not allowing the genetic expression to take place for an estrogenic effect. PCBs and dioxins are actually causing two things. One, they're causing oxidative stress inflammation, which is then destroying, in this illustration, the sperm cell. And they're also showing that it impacts binding to these XRE genetic transcriptional pathways, so it doesn't have an effect. There's a lot of diverse effects. You could spend your whole time, your whole life, looking at all the different mechanism pathways for different chemicals. It's not as simple as they always do one thing or the other. They're very diverse in their effects. They do have the ability to disrupt chemicals. Some of the most common endocrine disrupting chemicals, pesticides being very common, children's products, industrial solvents, lubricants, plastics, and food storage. This is the main one we get exposed to that we can't actually control. Electronic and building materials, personal care products, antibacterials. A lot of antibacterials have a lot of endocrine disrupting chemicals in them that we use all the time in the pandemic. And textiles and clothing, those are sprayed, especially with flame retardants. So a lot of children's products are sprayed with flame retardants, which really is the worst thing you could do. But that's something that you should, as a parent, take a very good look at if you do have children. And pesticides, you want to always look at the pesticides in your home. You can at least control the amount of pesticides that you get exposed to in your home and try to look at natural alternatives to things versus things like glyphosates. And BPA is really one of the most common exposures, and it doesn't get enough attention. And if you look at the most aggressive endocrine disrupting chemicals that impact female fertility, for example, you can see BPA is right here, but BPA-free is actually not bisphenol A, but bisphenol S, or bisphenol B, or bisphenol F, or bisphenol AF. So when they say BPA-free, it's not bisphenol-free. It's just bisphenol A-free. And bisphenol S and bisphenol B and F are way more aggressive of an endocrine disruptor. So you really want to avoid BPA-free stuff. So when you're dealing with patients, like this endocrine disrupting chemicals, like obviously everyone should avoid endocrine disrupting chemicals, but really when you're dealing with someone who's got like a hormone-sensitive tumor, like they have cervical cancer, they have breast cancer, this becomes a really big deal because these can be very stimulatory. When you're dealing with a child that has gynecomastia, these become a really big deal because even subtle effects with a certain population may have key effects on them. You're dealing with people that or in perimenopause for 5 years and they can't get under control, these things become a really big deal. So obviously, we want everyone to reduce their endocrine disrupting chemicals the best they can. Really, the best place is to start with is with plastic. And people just don't make this connection. And you can't drink out of plastic bottles. You just have to stop doing that. You have to have your patients get steel bottles, ceramic, glass. You can't store things in plastic. You got to store things in steel or glass. You can't use straws. Don't drink out of straws. Anything that's acidic or hot is going to leach BPA, okay? If you have something like Mountain Dew or some kind of soda, it's very acidic. That acidic nature of the soda is going to just leach BPA out of the straw or the cup. And all cups are coated with BPA. So the more acidic it is, like sodas or orange juice or things, the more BPA that's released. If it's heated, like coffee or tea, you're going to get a lot of BPA release. Don't drink out of coffee lids. Take the coffee lid off. Don't use straws. Try to use glass. These things make a difference. Even if the solution is in the glass for a certain amount of time, you're getting more of that BPA chemical that's released out there. It's very easy to be conscious of this thing once you get used to it, but until you're used to it, you can get a constant exposure. Now, picture a person drinking out of a BPA cup every day for 10 years. Think about the BPA load happens to that individual. And then what are they going to wait for them to get like breast cancer or hormone dysfunction that's very severe or obvious? And these cause subtle shifts in efficiency of pathways. Now, some people can clear BPA really quickly. Some people have lots of resiliency to endocrine disrupting chemicals, and some people don't. And those variables we don't really clearly understand, which makes it difficult for us as clinicians. But certainly people that have very sensitive hormone in conditions, you really need to be very particular to EPA and pesticides and so forth. When you look at the impact of pesticides and BPA being the two most common endocrine disruptors, the studies have shown they do everything. They can increase or decrease all the different hormones. They've been shown to impact sperm health in men and females. They've been shown to impact hormone synthesis, ovulation, altered menstrual cycles, risk factors for fetal health. And really, when you're looking at these endocrine disrupting chemicals, exposure is one side of it, but really the bigger part of it is, can the person clear them out of their body? That biotransformation is really where a lot of these problems come from. This was a paper that was published called "Disruption in Female Reproductive Functions by Endocrine Disrupting Chemicals May Result in Subfertility, Infertility, Improper Hormone Production, Estrous and Menstrual Cycle Abnormalities, Anovulation, and Reproductive Senescence." All these are possible. Now, you'll see me cite many papers. This is a very thorough review of how endocrine disrupting chemicals impact female endocrine function. And the other thing that's been coming up with endocrine disrupting chemicals is, what about in pregnancy? What happens? Can exposure in early life impact puberty development in girls over a period of time? And the answer is yes, there are some relationships there. They want to say in this paper that was titled Early Life Exposure to Endocrine Disrupting Chemicals and Pubertal Development in Girls, depending on whether the exposure takes place earlier during fetal and neonatal life or later during early childhood, endocrine disrupting chemicals can lead to different outcomes through different mechanisms. Evidence associated between exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals and ultrapubertal timing makes it reasonable to support these relationships. And then they go on to say, which is really important, however, human epidemiological data are limited or inconsistent and cannot provide sufficient evidence for a causal relationship, meaning A equals B, between endocrine disrupting chemicals and changes in pubertal timing. And one of the things you have to understand about all things in toxicology, all things related to chemicals and how it impacts human health, that aren't very aggressive like a poison that immediately kills you, but things that disrupt physiology, that it's not just dependent upon that trace exposure itself. It's a multivariate model. A univariate model is a direct A equals B. You have a hammer hit your hand, you feel pain. A equals B, right? Multivariate model, there's many things that are involved. So this was a great paper that was published in Endocrine Reviews in 2021, and it really went into, you can't look at these endocrine disrupting chemicals and how they impact fetal development and preconception as a direct cause, that there's genes that are involved, there's diet that's involved, there's the mother's health status that's involved, there's a dose relationship factor that's involved. All these different variables are involved. And this is where a lot of research is going in the field of toxicology, which is you need machine learning. You need statistical models that can look at a multivariate model. Most of the research models that we look at today, like these clinical trials where it's very simple, is the most basic form of statistical analysis you can do. It's something we can comprehend with our brains. But really, when you look at complex multivariate models, we do need artificial intelligence to find these relationships. And that's where we're going ahead of in the field of research, which will be great. And then we can find out which variables may have a greater impact, the other relationships, but we're not evolved enough as our statistical analysis yet as scientific field looking at some of these multivariate models. But they do have these relationships that are important. We just don't know exactly how impactful and significant they are with one person compared to another. Now, when you look at these endocrine disrupting chemical pathways, you can have an environmental pollutants. They can act as an endocrine disruptor. They can alter hormone signaling. They can cause obesity and insulin resistance, so-called an obesogen. Or they can promote inflammation, oxidative stress, which can damage reproductive tissue or promote autoimmunity. And let's go over this portion here first. Compete with hormones and receptor sites. So endocrine disrupting chemicals can impact things with the pituitary hypothalamic feedback loops that can directly impact things like the uterus and the ovaries at the receptor site level, at the enzymes that produce hormones. So every single pathway is up for grabs when it comes to endocrine disrupting chemicals. Now, PCOS being one of the most common endocrine disorders in females and one of the hardest to unwind, it has been shown to have a strong relationship with chemicals. This is a paper titled PCOS and Endocrine Disrupting Chemicals, and it goes and says it's plausible that developmental exposure to specific endocrine disrupting chemicals could permanently alter neuroendocrine reproductive metabolic regulation favoring polycystic ovary syndrome development in genetically predisposed individuals. Or it could accelerate and or exacerbate the natural course of a syndrome throughout life cycle exposure. And the reason this paper is important, I want to highlight it, is because just because endocrine disrupting chemicals may or may not impact some of your patients or even yourself, doesn't mean that's the same for everyone. You're going to have some patients that if you dramatically reduce their chemical load, it may be the first time they may respond. And when you're dealing with patients, especially with complex patterns like polycystic ovary syndrome, and again, this vicious cycle of high insulin, high testosterone, one of the things you have to throw in the loop, besides a whole list of things we'll have to discuss about improving insulin signaling and the microbiome and biotransformation pathways, is reducing the endocrine load. This is a condition you really cannot ignore the impact of pesticides and plastic products. And they've found some very clear relationships that cause ongoing persistent patterns with people, and it can be a big deal for many females that have PCOS. Now, BPA, bisphenol A plastics, is the most common and most severe daily exposure of endocrine-disrupting chemicals that can't be ignored. Now, here's what they're showing with PCOS patterns. What they're finding is like BPA, bisphenol A, as you drink your plastic compounds or stored food in plastics or heat food in plastics, those chemicals that are released, they have a direct effect on ovarian thecal cells. They increase the steroidogenic enzymes that are making androgens. So the BPA itself turns on the stimulation of making androgens. Insulin will do this as well, but BPA has a stimulating effect directly on those pathways. And then BPA has a direct effect on the liver, and it impacts sex hormone-binding goblin ligands, and it decreases the pathways in the liver to clear testosterone. BPA not only makes the ovaries produce more androgens, but it also, BPA also impacts the liver, so it can't hydroxylate testosterone, so it can't clear out estrogens. Both those lead to high androgens. So when you have a female patient that has high insulin, high testosterone, they have hair loss, they have hair thinning, they have weight gain, they have abnormal cycles, all the things that go on with PCOS, the most common female endocrine disorder in healthcare, okay, you can see this very powerful effect on BPA on these pathways. And then when you look at over here, BPA directly impacts the receptor sites for androgens, and it can either amplify or interfere with the androgenic effect, disrupting androgen metabolism itself. And then androgens, when they're high, as in BPA, they have an effect on the liver, which impacts this UDP, glucuronidase transferase activity, where now they can't clear BPA. As they take BPA, their BPA stimulates their ovaries to produce more androgens. The BPA makes their liver not be able to clear out their androgens. Androgens are high. And then androgens have an effect on slowing down the clearance of BPA in the system. And you get stuck in this vicious cycle. The only way around this is to reduce the BPA load and then every other variable. But this is really a big deal. The other key thing with BPA, which you want to understand, is that it does stimulate adipose tissue development, which is a big part of PCOS. And adipocytes are part of the web of chronic polycystic ovarian syndrome patterns and insulin resistance. And BPA has a direct stimulatory effect on these adipocytes to produce these inflammatory mediators to promote more fat buildup and also create inflammatory mediators that then disrupt the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian loop. And by the way, just so you guys know, if you guys are working with a lot of female patients with menstrual cycle irregularities and infertility, you're going to have the most common cause be PCOS. PCOS is really easy to identify. It's just going to be, if you find levels of high testosterone in the follicular phase or luteal phase, it can disrupt every part of female hormone pathways. Ovulation, follicular development, corpus luteum output of progesterone. You can get amenorrhea, dysmenorrhea. You can get PMS. You can get basically any type of female menstrual abnormality with PCOS. And the most common endocrine disorder in menstruating females is not deficiency, it's PCOS. And BPA has such an aggressive impact on it, which is mind-blowing why there isn't more attention placed on just making a very strong effort to completely reduce BPA exposure with patients that are dealing with PCOS. Okay? PCOS is devastating. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to work with many patients with PCOS. PCOS is devastating to female patients, especially young female patients, like when they're 17, 18, 16, 14, because they gain weight. They can't lose it. Their hair falls out. Nothing they do with exercise works. Nothing to do with dietary restriction works. And they're at a point where they feel hopeless. And there's long-term studies now of like massive depression, increased suicides, serious health problems with PCOS, okay? And trust me when I tell you, birth control pills are not going to fix this either, which is the treatment that they're using with some androgen blockers. These are complex webs of disorders, and endocrine-disrupting chemicals have a huge impact on this condition, okay? Now, part of this pattern of these endocrine-disrupting chemicals is the fact they also are obesogens. They promote obesity, and it's not just BPA, but other chemicals that are found in air pollution and pesticides and carpet glue and cigarette smoke, these things all have the ability to impact insulin signaling pathways. And what you're going to find is with like insulin signaling pathways, in female patients, insulin signaling pathways are going to cause PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, where insulin increases testosterone and testosterone throws everything off. And in males, insulin is going to stimulate aromatase, which is going to convert men's testosterone to estrogen and then cause this loss of testosterone dominance in a male, where they then have all the symptoms of a testosterone insufficiency. And you can't change these endocrine disrupting chemicals that are in the environment, in the soil, in the air at some level, but you can change things you're exposed to at home, like carpet glue, cigarette smoke, not having good air quality in your home, cosmetics. These things are things that you really have to take into account with patients that have complex endocrine disorders. We went into this in a lot of detail in the Crosby and Institute Diabetes course. And just to highlight a few things, there's been very clear relationships between chemical production of these endocrine disrupting chemicals and diabetes prevalence. And some of these epidemiological studies and lots of correlations specifically with endocrine disrupting chemicals and diabetes development, insulin resistance development. And there's something that really can't be, you shouldn't ignore them with complex PCOS patients. Now, the other part of endocrine disrupting chemicals, besides altering hormone signaling and acting as obesogens and compounds that impact insulin resistance, is the fact that these chemicals can lead to oxidative stress. And they can actually damage the testes, they can damage the ovaries, they can damage thyroid signaling pathways, and if not damaged, it can cause inflammation that can disrupt steroidogenesis. So this is an illustration from a paper that was published as a review talking about oxidative stress that can lead to infertility. And the total load of things we all get exposed to, various chemicals, maybe even car exhaust, tobacco smoke, systemic inflammation, to some degree we all have some degree of that, various things that then increase free radicals are only balanced by the amount of antioxidant defenses you have. And over a period of time, you can deplete your antioxidant defenses. And ultimately is, okay, you get into endocrine disrupting chemical exposure, yes, it can bind to chemicals and cause some receptor issues, but it can cause inflammation. The counterbalance to this is how much antioxidants you have. Increased depletion of antioxidants from chronic exposure to these environmental chemicals, or even things just like chronic tobacco smoking, alcohol, and whatever, may lead to like protein damage, lipid peroxidation. These things, for example, this show in an illustration showing to damage sperm. I'll show you some other studies here in a second that show the testicular lytic cells, which is testosterone in males, are extremely vulnerable to inflammation. And many young men and old men that lose their ability to make testosterone have it because of too much oxidative stress, where these cells get destroyed. And then these oxidative stress pathways have also been shown to impact infertility in females, everything from impacting their follicle release, their follicle implantation, the health of the structure of an endometrium. And if they don't have enough antioxidants to reduce the free radical stress, you can get these major shifts. And even with people that do active, they do ART therapy where they get implantation done, artificial implantation through fertility treatments, the more free radicals they have, the less likely that their procedure will work. Now, when you look at chemicals, and chemicals not necessarily being endocrine disrupting chemicals, but chemicals being a source of depleting antioxidants, one of the things you're going to see is that chemicals have a very powerful effect on breaking down the blood testes barrier. There's a testicular barrier called the BTB, blood testes barrier, and this barrier is what protects the lytic cells, which produce testosterone, and the Sertoli cells, which produce sperm, from toxic compounds and oxidants and free radicals that can destroy them. And here you can see another illustration. You can see the blood testes barrier here. And as long as this blood barrier is there, then these cells can make testosterone and sperm. But people end up with leaky blood testes barriers, like people get leaky gut, leaky blood-brain barriers. You have things like zonulin and catenin alpha, catenin beta, which are these tight junction proteins in the blood vessels. These can also break down. And chemicals, like cadmium is going to be like in cigarette smoke, it's going to have cadmium and benzenes from like car exhaust. They're just everyday exposure to basic chemicals can easily break down these Sertoli cells. And there's a high degree of infertility in men and low testosterone output and lytic cell failure if they're smokers, just people that smoke cigarettes all day. they get a lot of this exposure and breakdown of their chemical-induced blood-brain barrier, leaky testes barriers, in a sense. And this is a study here where they went into and showed how chemicals strictly just damage the testes itself. They cause inflammation in the testes, which doesn't allow sperm production. They directly destroy the cells of the testes. They interfere with genetic pathways in these spheres, and they disrupt the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. So ultimately, when you're looking at chemicals, you have this relationship between oxidative stress and inflammation and destruction of these cells. You had a study where they looked at a section of Sertoli lytic cells here. It represented Sertoli cells. And then once there was cadmium exposure, even though they had FSH receptors binding to FSH, they weren't able to produce sperm very well. And here they did the same thing with lytic cells in this area here, with cadmium levels that were elevated. Even though the luteinizing hormone had an effect on binding to the lytic cells, there was deficiency in the ability to produce testosterone. So a lot of these testosterone imbalances could just be excess chemical free radical issues that are taking place, and really ultimate ways to really use antioxidants. And antioxidants have been shown to protect this pathway, so it's really critical to look in those scenarios. Now, the question is, who needs antioxidants? Because everyone needs antioxidants. But if you guys see a 16-year-old boy that's not making testosterone, or a 17-year-old that doesn't have testosterone, or a 40-year-old guy that has testosterone levels that are very low, below the lab range, you may want to look at, hey, how much free radical exposure do you get? Maybe they work in a chemical environment. Maybe they smoke. Maybe they're stuck in traffic all day. Maybe if you can reduce those exposures, maybe put them in a high amount of different antioxidant cocktails for a few weeks, see if it can make a difference for them. But these cells in the testes are very sensitive to just free radical stress, okay? Okay, we get exposed to toxins, what can we do? So one side of it is take antioxidants. Antioxidants basically take the bullet, the free radical damage to the tissue, so the tissue doesn't get damaged, and then in this case, for example, like males, there's no testicular damage as well. So chemicals will first destroy the testicular barrier. Once they destroy the barrier, then destroy the Leydig cells and Sertoli cells. So the goal is to have antioxidants at high enough level where there's protection there. Now, the other things that improve resiliency to environmental chemical challenges, make sure they have the ability to detoxify or clear out hormones. So that's where biotransformation comes in. And this is where microbiome transformation takes place. Microbiome biotransformation really requires on diversity. Right? Hepatic biotransformation really depends on having healthy amounts of B vitamins, healthy amount of methylation, healthy amount of sulfur, healthy amounts of glucuronide. Those are all key things. So now, the steps you may want to consider clinically when you see a chemical load, you see a female patient with PCOS, you see a male that isn't making testosterone, and you want to look at this endocrine pathway related to chemicals, is number one, reduce formation of reactive oxygen species, limit exposure to toxic chemicals the best you can. Number two, increase antioxidant levels to stabilize free radicals. It's honestly, more is better. This is how I take antioxidants. I just feel it. I don't count pills. I just add it on. I feel like I need more today. You just want to get used to taking them. And the same thing with patients that are going through this. Just look at their budget, see what they can handle. Things like N-acetylcysteine are very effective, not very expensive. Any antioxidant you can get in them. Things like vitamin C, not very expensive. They can take high doses of things like vitamin C and NAC, have a tremendous effect on glutathione. Optimized hepatic biotransformation. There's many nutraceuticals out there to support the phase 1, phase 2 pathways with cofactors. And then reduce household chemicals. Water filters, plastic-free containers, cleaning products, air filters, chemical-free cosmetics. There's going to be patients in a clinical setting to deal with. And you're like, okay, you're stuck. You've tried everything. We don't know what to do. Let's say we're going to work on stabilizing your blood sugar. We're going to make sure you sleep well. We got to reduce the chemical load you have in your home. And we're going to increase your free radical antioxidant status. And those are things you may work through with a patient over a period of time in a functional medicine model. Now, how to reduce your household chemical load, water filters, we'll talk about this a little bit more in the next section here, but house filtering system, drinking water, shower head, and then for cups, food containers, and plates that have to be steel, glass, or ceramic, get rid of the plastics. You've got to use chemical-free cleaning products. Use natural compound insecticides. You want to definitely have fire retardant-free upholstered furniture. The only way you know it's fire retardant-free is if you ask for it and make sure it is, or you use vintage furniture or reupholster your furniture yourself. If you buy most furniture today, it's already sprayed with fire retardants. And then the worst thing you can have in your home is like vinyl flooring with the off-gassing. Carpets, if you don't vacuum your carpets, you can have a lot of problems. And also carpets that are very old have a lot of formaldehyde release. Wood floorings would be best with natural coatings like oils. Stone would be best. And then air filter, you definitely want air filters like HIPAA filters all throughout your homes. This is, if you have a patient that has an estrogen-positive cancer, all this would be really important. If you had a little boy in your office that's crying because they have gynecomastia and they're having some serious psychological development issues happening, this stuff becomes really important. If a person doesn't really feel anything and that doesn't notice any difference, then I can maybe make all this effort into it. But there definitely be cases where all these little things will make a difference. And you have a highly motivated person, family, that wants to know everything they can possibly do to improve endocrine function, reducing household chemical levels would be a key issue there. Now, let's talk about more specific things, like hormones in the water supply. Yes, there is hormones in the water supply. There is estrogen from birth control pills, ethyl estradiol in surface waters. Okay, and when you look at studies, they found statements like this. This is published in an environmental journal. Yeah, we found these chemicals, but removing oral contraceptives from the market would be detrimental to women's health and their ability to decide the timing and spacing of their children, and would have societal and global impacts. I'll say, yeah, it's there. It does cause harm to the environment. They can have harm and effects with endocrine function. Because water treatment places are not going to clear this out in most cases. And you definitely want to have filters in your home to clear out pharmaceuticals and estrogens from your drinking water, and for patients that have endocrine-sensitive conditions as well. This was another paper that was published. Hormones and pharmaceuticals in groundwater used as a source of drinking water across the United States. This is the first large-scale systematic assessment of hormone and pharmaceutical occurrence in groundwater used for drinking water in the United States. Samples from 1,091 sites in principal aquifers representing 60% of the volume of pumped and drinking water supply had a final data of 21 hormones and 103 pharmaceuticals in there. And it goes into all the specific chemicals they found and the different medications they found in the water content, okay? So, again, with some conditions that are very sensitive, estrogen-sensitive conditions, hormone-sensitive conditions, these things can be more of a big concern than others, but overall, for everyone's health, you should really consider removing these things. Now, we also know that there's hormones in anabolic compounds and animal sources. They basically use steroids, estrogens. Here you can see hormones such as steroidal estrogens, gestagens, or synthetic progesterones, if you haven't heard that term, androgens, non-steroidal, semi-synthetic, and synthetic designer drugs are all growth-promoting and body partitioning agents. They're used in food and animal products, and they really just stimulate growth in these compounds that are used in livestock. Eventually get into the air, they get into the waste, they get into our water, they get into our streams, and we get exposed to in our homes, in our drinking water. When you look at things like 17, like trenbolone acetate, because that's what, if you see the bodybuilders that look like aliens because they're so big, they're taking these type of steroids to grow. The fact that some of this stuff is in drinking water from being used in animal feed is really frustrating and devastating for us to see that. And these steroids can stick in soil. You can have kids play in dirt. You can have crops grow in soil. These hormones get into our food products. Even if you're vegetarian, these compounds can impact in some of the foods as well. And they're a problem. This was another paper that was published, occurrence of multi-class endocrine disrupting compounds in drinking water supply system and associated risk. Among 18 screened compounds, 14 multi-class endocrine disrupting chemicals were detected in the drinking water supply system, encompassing both drinking water sources and supply tap water. So even in tap water, they found these endocrine disrupting chemicals. So what do? You definitely want, for your own home, for your patient's home, you want to get a house filter system. So the house filter system is going to be attached to where water comes into the home. And if you want to get rid of environmental endocrine disrupting chemicals and estrogens and so forth, you want to get reverse osmosis charcoal system. It's like the standard that's used. I don't sell any. I don't know where you can buy them. Do your own research. Don't ask me. But those are the guidelines, okay? You want to get a house filter system. I have one of my own, and that's to the base. And then you want to have another layer of level is another filtering system from the home system even to your water wouldn't be a bad idea. Like a countertop water filter system, or you know, some refrigerators have a very good water filter system. You want to have multiple layers of water filtering systems that come into your home, especially for yourself, just for your general health, and also for your patients that may have a very complicated PCOS or a complicated endocrine disorder or a childhood developmental endocrine imbalance or things like that. Let's talk about hormones and food a little bit more. You also have to understand, from a different point of view, there are natural hormones in foods unrelated to what the food industry is giving these cattle to eat to make them grow. So this was a study of a paper that was published looking at a German market basket where they were looking at cattle that is not exposed to these practices they do in the U.S. where they inject all these different steroids in animals to make them grow. When you look at normal animal products like milk, fat, and cream, and animal meats, they do have some natural steroid hormones. Not synthetic, not steroids. And in this paper here, if you want to get a chance to read it, they go into the specifics here. But the natural occurrence of sex steroid hormones, progesterone, testosterone, 70-beta-estriol, and estrogen in food was investigated by surveying German American baskets. Milk and milk fat products reflect hormone profiles of female cattle with high amounts of progesterone and accumulating in milk content. Eggs are a considerable source of investigated steroids and contribute to the nutritional hormone intake the same order as meat and fish. In vegetable food, no estrogens could be detected. Okay. And then here is another paper. And by the way, this is not bad. One of the things that we're also understanding about hormones in food is when we eat animal products, there is some naturally occurring hormones that is a way to actually give our system more hormones. And actually, you're going to see some of the most difficult patients to turn around with endocrine disorders like dysmenorrhea, amenorrhea, will be your vegan patients for many reasons. But one of the reasons is that you actually do get occurrence of some naturally occurring steroid hormones that we do ingest. Some of them are from animal products, and some of them are for like phytoestrogens and plant sterols. Things like soy, legumes, oil seeds, grains contain phytoestrogens and different plant sterols. They also seem to have an effect on our general endocrine function. And this was a review paper that was published, Hormones in Dairy Foods and Their Impact on Public Health. In summary, it seems that steroid hormones are very potent compounds in dairy foods, which exert powerful biological effects in animals and humans. Most of the previous knowledge about steroids occurring in the physiological, sometimes superphysiological concentration of steroids, but recently it is found that these compounds, even at very low dose, may have significant biological effects. And they go on to show that unrelated to just like superdose steroid cattle, that naturally occurring hormones occur in cream, yogurt, and cheeses and foods that we eat. And this may be one of the reasons why we also maintain some degree of hormone function as we age, as we eat regular food that's not been totally processed. We do get a certain amount of hormones in animal products naturally. But as they've manipulated the food supply, it's been too aggressive and we're getting some issues. So the takeaway message from this is animal products, eggs, milk, meat, naturally provide bioidentical hormones that support human health. And this is, again, back to, I got to tell you, in my practice, I don't work with vegan patients anymore. And I don't work with them because I have any prejudice against what they're doing. Whatever they're doing is good for them. I don't have any judgment against them. I don't know how to help them. They get to the point where I don't have the tools, I don't have the know-how with their diet to sometimes make things change. If I see a patient as a new patient inquiry into my office and they're like, do a workup, I always review, see what's there, because you only have so many patients you can see as a new patient per month and you want to take ones that you want to actually have an effect with. If you see like dysmenorrhea, amenorrhea, fatigue, exhaustion, vegan, like I just don't have the ability to do anything for them in my clinical model. And some of you that may be more experienced may be able to do other things for them, but it becomes very difficult. And part of the reason is not just that they're not getting B12 and folate, but they may not be getting some dietary hormones from animal products that are actually a part of normal physiology. Okay. Now, another key concept, exogenous hormone implants in farm cattle to increase body mass use extremely powerful synthetic hormones that may impact normal metabolism. That's the issue we're having with stuff in the U.S. A lot of U.S. meats are banned in Europe. Ideally, milk and animal products should be consumed from animals not given antibiotics, synthetic hormones, or feed-containing pesticides. Okay. So that's the issue with hormones in foods. Okay, let's talk about hormones in cosmetics. There's lots of endocrine-disrupting chemicals in cosmetics, mascara, lipstick, fake tans. Fake tan is the worst. If you want to really expose your body to endocrine-disrupting chemicals, go get a fake tan. That's just like adding to it. Get a fake tan and then have a coffee with a coffee lid on it. Get some BPA in there and then wonder why your hormones are messed up. Okay? And add some foundation and some lipstick. You're definitely winning with the endocrine-disrupting buildup. Okay, there's a lot of chemicals in cosmetics that are not reported. There was a study that was published, Advances in Hormones Cosmetics, Legal Addition to Status, Sample Preparing and Detection Technology, in 2023, when they looked at the amounts of non-reported hormones in cosmetics. And there's a lot of estrogens and there's a lot of steroids that are put in cosmetics, especially face masks. They're not reported on the label because they work. They bring inflammation down. They make the skin feel different. They make the skin feel moist. And if you guys ever look at, let's say, like an adrenal salivary profile, and like cortisol is off the charts, you may even have a lab alert, cortisol off the charts. Most of the time, those are from cosmetic sources. Or they can sometimes be from like an anti-inflammatory cream that someone's using for a rash. But they're loaded with very high amounts of different types of cortisone and hydrocortisone and so forth. So in this paper, they went through and looked at the different non-reported hormones in cosmetic products, and they found lots of synthetic steroids and different forms of estrogens. 64.1% of the compounds that had the highest amounts of unreported chemicals were face masks. Face masks followed by face cream and toner. Those are the highest source of unreported endocrine-disrupting chemicals that are found out there. So this is something else to be very conscious of, especially with your patients that have very delicate endocrine system functions that need to be addressed. Then we have another issue, which is endocrine disruptors in air particles, like air pollution. And men are extremely sensitive to this. So air pollution is a significant risk factor for men having hypogonadal failure and having testes dysfunction. And this first paper here was a study that looked at the effects of short-term exposure to ambient air pollution and reproductive hormones in young males. It was a study of 2,030 blood sample patients, and they basically found this direct relationship between the degree of air pollution they found in their blood and the amount of testosterone they produced, showing that these chemicals definitely have this effect. And when you look at some of these associations with hormone levels in men, you'll see multiple studies that have in your course materials about this. They also end up causing lung inflammation. There's lots of relationships now in the literature between air pollution, turning on adrenal gland cortisol output. Typically, we think people that have cortisol abnormalities in their profiles may just have issues with stress in their life and maybe blood sugar dysregulation, but air pollution is a major driver through the pulmonary immune system to activate cortisone and cortisol response to help with respiration and breathing that can also impact levels on a cortisol profile. And this is a detailed paper if you guys want to check out in your notes. It really goes into this gut-lung axis dysfunction and the microbiome. But they basically find the health of the microbiome determines how active the lung inflammatory and stress response is to air pollution. And the key takeaway is basically improve microbiome function to help with lung pulmonary responses that can then activate the adrenal stress response, and so forth. This is a paper that was published that showed how gut microbiota can have an impact on different endocrine-disrupting chemicals specifically, and different bacterial species may have the ability to clear out different types of chemicals. So this is why it's so important to have diversity of chemicals, because the more diverse the bacteria are in the gut, the more diversity these different bacteria have different pathways to clear out different chemicals and so forth. Okay. And then these are some other papers showing these microbiota changes with insulin resistance and they're important. Before we go into exercise and lifestyle things, the key thing with endocrine disrupting chemicals are, for some patients, they don't mean anything. For some patients, you're wasting time. That's not the main issue. You could have a patient that has a raging hypoglycemic lifestyle. Unless you get your blood sugar stable, you're not going to be able to fix anything. You could have a patient that has hormonal issues, and maybe the hormonal issues are really driven by, for example, very significant and abusive relationship that's really throwing off the stress response that's being overlooked. And in those cases, endocrine disrupting chemicals don't mean much. But you will have cases where you have a PCOS patient that's so extremely difficult to unwind, where you have a young child going through puberty with missing milestones or not filling in with the milestones. You will have patients that have history of breast cancer or cervical cancer that you're working with. You could have a person that is on hormones and all of a sudden they have proliferation in certain tissues and have a big fibroid grow. In those cases, really looking at endocrine function and its role with endocrine disrupting chemicals becomes really important. Get rid of plastics, clear the home, optimize the microbiome, support biotransformation pathways, get air filters, HIPAA filters in each room, get water filters in each area, be very careful with cosmetics, use natural pesticides around the home. You can make a huge difference in those pathways. Okay, it takes effort from the patient and family to do those. Now, let's get into lifestyle. Exercise dramatically impacts hormones and hormone function. This was a paper, a systematic review paper of 33 studies called The Effects of Exercise Training in Anabolic Catabolic Hormones with Advanced Age. In conclusion, finding from the systematic review suggests that exercise training increases basal levels of testosterone, IGF-1, sex hormone binding globulin, growth hormone, DHEA in both males and females over 4 years of age. The increase in blood levels of these hormones are independent of the mode, duration, intensity of training programs. Meaning that any kind of exercise changes hormones, but other studies I'll share in a second shows intensity does impact things like growth hormone and testosterone more than anything else. So intensity is a key factor. But for the most part, if someone's sedentary, they're not going to activate their endocrine system to make hormones. So one of the ways that people maintain their hormone function throughout their lifespan and optimize their own mood and energy and reproductive properties is just the fact they have some type of physical activity. So sedentary lifestyles is devastating for general hormone function altogether. Every major hormone can be changed with exercise. Basically, what they found with menopause, the vasomotor symptoms like hot flashes, the psychological symptoms that take place in perimenopause, the body pains, sexually reported symptoms, all dramatically change if there's any type of exercise in the regimen. So from perimenopause, it becomes extremely important to have any kind of physical activity, any kind of movement to mitigate those symptoms, unrelated to whatever hormone replacement they're on. This is another paper that was published. It was the meta-analysis, systematic review of 19 studies, exercise intervention and polycystic ovary syndrome. And with PCOS, again, being such a difficult condition to treat, the key thing is that it had to be vigorous, intense exercise to really make a difference. So results from analysis support the use of exercise suggest that vigorous intensity exercises may have the greatest impact in cardiorespiratory fitness, body composition, and insulin resistance. Our results indicate that a minimum of 120 minutes of vigorous intensity per week is needed to provide favorable health outcomes for women with PCOS. And this is important because sometimes people have polycystic ovary syndrome. They go, just go for a walk. Just go for a casual walk every day because that's not going to do anything. Okay. For certain conditions like PCOS where insulin is driving testosterone aggressively, there has to be some intense exercise. And if you're like looking at a male to really increase their growth hormone, you really need high intense exercise. So here's just a chart of different exercise intensities for your notes. And ultimately, the more intense the exercise, the greater growth hormone release and other hormone pathways and the best improvement on insulin receptor signaling, but also the greater effect on overtraining syndrome. So you have this U-shaped pattern where you have benefits and benefits until you have excess, and then with excess you start to have failure. And then when men get metabolic overtraining syndrome, their sperm and testosterone go down, and women, their ovulation gets disrupted, so they get all types of menstrual cycle irregularities. This is a paper that just defined this U-shaped association with exercise of this overtraining pattern. And as the clinician, you want to be able to know what the signs of overtraining syndrome are. So you want your patients, when you're looking at hormone balance, to exercise. the more intense it is, the better, especially for insulin and growth hormone release, but the greater chance that they overtrain. And once someone gets into metabolic overtraining syndromes, what you'll find with them is they're just not able to recover from workouts. They can't complete their workouts. They start to get injured. They're not motivated to work out anymore. And the best scenario is you want someone to work hard enough where they're motivated the next day to go back out and work out, and they can recover from one workout to the next. Now, as men and women have their testosterone levels go down, this becomes a major problem. Testosterone is critical for both men and women to have recovery from workouts and to support muscle mitochondria. Another big clue you should be aware of is your men and women that have low testosterone are very prone to having metabolic overtraining syndromes. And as a matter of fact, when men and women that have low testosterone go on testosterone replacement, they are so surprised of how fast they recover from working out. Even we're talking about just being in normal limits, not steroids, just normal physiological testosterone, how quickly they can recover from workouts and how much easier it is to gain benefits. When men or women become testosterone deficient, they don't realize they're dealing with an uphill battle. Okay? And then this overtraining syndrome pattern here where stress hormones take place, gonadal hormones are involved, there's cellular inflammation, and I made this chart for you that really goes into the spectrum of symptoms that take place with overtraining syndrome. Reproductive hormones are involved, systemic inflammation takes place. So one of the things we'll talk about in the evaluation and treatment strategy later is looking at exercise as a lifestyle therapy to support with endocrine disorders, but you have to look at intensity, you got to look at duration, and you got to look at frequency. And their pre-existing chronic disease, their pre-existing systemic inflammation, lack of sleep, poor nutrition, psychological stress is going to determine how quickly they can get into a metabolic overtraining syndrome, which you need to avoid. And then you got to figure out the right intensity, duration, and frequency to make a difference there. The key concepts are the greater the intensity of exercise, the greater the impact on growth hormone and hormone optimization. So intensity does make a difference. Patients with insulin resistance leading to polycystic ovarian syndrome or obesity-related hypogonadism require higher intensity exercise to reverse insulin resistance. Because really simply put, men with increased body fat will have inflammation from the body fat that wipes out their testicolytic cells. Women that have increased body fat will tend to have a PCOS pattern where they become insulin resistant and produce too much testosterone. Those patterns both require higher intensity exercise in order to reverse that insulin pattern. They're not going to be able to get it with lower intensity. Next key concept. Exercise intensity, exercise duration, exercise frequency at levels beyond metabolic fitness can lead to overtraining syndrome and lead to hormone imbalances. You actually will have some patients. That's why they have hormone imbalances. They're just overtraining. And then lastly, regular exercise with the highest intensity that does not lead to overtraining syndrome is critical for hormone optimization. Okay? Now let's get into lifestyle a little bit more. Let's talk about body composition. You have to remember that body fat is actually now considered part of the endocrine system. They used to think body fat was just storage of calories, but body fat releases hormones. And we'll go over the list of different hormones it releases, but it helps modulate the rest of the endocrine system. And either low body mass index or high body mass index have been associated with hormone imbalances. Low body mass index, there's not enough fat cells to release different types of gonadotropins and adipokines to stimulate the endocrine system. We'll go into that detail a little bit more in the next section. And then high body mass index causes these inflammatory adaptive adipokines and promotion of insulin resistance, which can cause increased androgens in females, increased estrogen in males, pituitary feedback dysregulations. A body mass index is going to be a factor of a person's ability to manage their hormones and potentially one of the reasons why their hormone systems are out of balance. So with increased body mass index, we know that there's a vicious cycle here, and women, once they get into perimenopause, the menopause, as they become estrogen deficient, their body's ability to burn body fat becomes hindered. It's not uncommon to see women that didn't have any weight issues hit into perimenopause, and they lose their estradiol levels, and they start to gain weight easier, and as they get more weight, that creates its own vicious cycle. And there are some women that need estrogens. And as soon as they go on estrogens, boom, their insulin is under control, their metabolism is back in shape, and they're functioning. So it's definitely something to be aware of. And if a person gains weight in perimenopause, they find that after about 2 years, there's a window of 2 years of weight gain even postmenopause what's there. So that early in transition to perimenopause and then 2 years after postmenopause is where you have the greatest fluctuation of estrogens that can then impact body fat. And body fat itself, especially when it's activated by inflammatory pathways or insulin, can release these different types of adipokines that can increase insulin sensitivity, or they can cause inhibit ovarian testicular steroidogenesis, inhibit LH, inhibit FSH, and then throw off hormones as well. You're going to see like a lot of metabolic endocrine disorders can change just by a person. If they just lose 10 pounds, their whole endocrine system profile can completely change on a lab test. And sometimes you don't want to waste a lot of time using a lot of botanicals and herbs to try to stimulate certain pathways and try to raise some things when they can just have a huge difference as they change their behavior. The key thing with fetal obesity is that it increases insulin, which causes PCOS, increased systemic inflammation, risk for endometriosis. The more fat buildup they have, the more body fat can retain endocrine disrupting chemicals. That's the other key thing. Body fat itself is a storage for endocrine disrupting chemicals. And you'll also see some people, as they lose weight, have significant hormone symptoms as these endocrine disrupting chemicals get released into their bloodstream. So they may be feeling worse as they're losing weight and then eventually stabilize and feel better. There's also increased risks of complications with that as well. Now, in men, there's this direct relationship between obesity causing elevated estrogens and lower testosterone. And in this case, they also found reduced androgens and sex hormone binding globulins. As men gain more body fat, the body fat causes aromatization where the estrogen levels go up. Their sex hormone binding globulins go down, which you would think would cause more free testosterone. But what actually happens is their total testosterone goes down at the same time, so there's no benefit. In this paper that was published called Adipose Tissue Dysfunction and Obese-Related Male Hypogonadism, and they really show these vicious cycles of adipose tissue, increased body fat, releasing these kinds of cell messengers released by body fat. Leptin goes up, adipectin goes down, free radicals go up. These inflammatory mediators then directly cause disruption of the lytic cells, so testosterone levels drop. I'll show you some studies in the next section, direct linear relationships of how much body fat a person has and their total testosterone level. So very, very interesting connections there. And then here you can see hormonal alterations associated with obesity. You can see at the fat tissue itself, it stimulates the enzyme called aromatase, which converts testosterone to estrogen. So they get this increased estrogen level, and then it inhibits their testicular testosterone lytic cell functions, and the testosterone levels go down. So you would almost expect male with obesity to have those patterns. And then here you can see, and by the way, if you take a male with obesity with those patterns and you put them on androgel and they rub testosterone into their body fat, that gets aromatized into their bloodstream. How it gets to the bloodstream, it looks like they're taking an estrogen cream. You'll have a person that has like low testosterone, high estrogen. They go on androgel, they get a repeat test, and it's almost as if they were taking pure estradiol. So you got to be careful with that. Injections are definitely the way to go for those cases. We'll talk about that more with the clinical patterns. Male obesity basically causes oxidative stress, damages the blood testes barrier, destroys the Sertoli cells, destroys the lytic cells, causes rage inflammatory reactions, impairs hormone signaling, and changes vascular dynamics. And these are like obviously the main issues, right? Sedentary lifestyle, too much fried foods, consumption of sugars, too much carbs, not enough fiber, caloric intake that's greater than caloric demand, metabolic imbalances, lack of sleep, stress without coping skills, hormone issue that's underlying thyroid issue that's not identified, things of that nature. Now, underweight individuals also can have major issues with hormone imbalances. And underweight individuals may not have enough body fat to release adipokines that are critical for regulation of the endocrine system. So you have to understand, in females, one of the main ways females make estrogens is they take some of the androsteroidione and DHEA made by their ovaries and their adrenal glands by the enzyme aromatase and body fat into estrogens. So in females, it's a critical way for them to maintain their estrogens, to have body fat. In males, we don't want this increased aromatase activity, but in females, we definitely want it. So when we see a female patient that loses too much body fat and is underweight, low BMI, they may not be able to have the aromatase activity from being underweight to produce estrogens. You can see very low estrogens with them. The other key thing is body fat, and we'll go over this in more detail in the next section, releases these adipokines that regulate gonadotropins, LH and FSH modulation, insulin signaling, immune regulation of energy and metabolism. And when someone's underweight, this can be a major disruptive factor as well. Complex endocrine condition, patient's underweight. As soon as they get weight under control, everything normalizes. You're going to see that in your own practice all the time. You're going to have a lot of these underweight, complete endocrine failures out there that never really get that addressed, and it becomes a major issue with them. So what can happen with underweight function, and in this case infertility, not enough fat tissue, not enough aromatase action, not enough estrogens, not enough feedback loop coordination, inability to have adipokines and leptins to impact dopamine for the normal hypothalamic pituitary pathway action, and you get severe endocrine dysfunction. Sometimes the minute a patient walks in that's chronically has endocrine dysfunction, like they're totally underweight, that's the first place you need to start. Don't play around with all these different botanicals and herbs and nutraceuticals. Just try to get their body mass index up. And for some people, it's very difficult. And it's just as difficult for some people to get their weight up as it is for some people to get their weight down. It may be even harder for some people to get their weight up than it is for people to get their weight down. Decreased caloric intake, malabsorption syndromes are things you definitely want to think about. But a lot of times it's just not, you have to do a deep dive and figure out what's going on with their dietary consumption of foods and why they're not getting enough calories. Okay? Key concepts from this section. Low body mass index in males and females leads to impaired gonadotropin release. Okay? Low body fat in females leads to reduced potential to synthesize estrogens from aromatase and body fat. Increased body fat in males leads to increased conversion of testosterone to estrogens, and increased body fat promotes inflammation and pituitary dysregulation from increased release of adipokines. We'll go over that research more in the next section. Okay. Now, another key factor you have to look at with lifestyle for balancing hormones, optimizing hormones, is muscle mass. You have to have muscles. And as we get older, we all lose some degree of muscle, especially if we're inactive. So physical inactive people can lose as much as 3 to 5% of their muscle mass a decade after age 30. And symptoms of sarcopenia just include loss of stamina, difficulty performing daily activities, walking slowly, trouble climbing stairs, poor balance and falls, decrease in muscle mass, different muscles in between the different layers of the triceps and biceps, just fat, 65 compared to age 25, that's sarcopenia. And then you have to have muscles. And there's some people that have sarcopenic obesity or skinny fat. They don't look fat because they have no muscles. They just have fat. You see this in a lot of Asian populations. And muscle mass is critical because muscles release something called myokines. And myokines, like you see here, activate the hypothalamic pituitary activate system. And this here, you can see physical activity enhances circulating levels of myokines, and the bloodstream affects the brain, regulating neuronal proliferation, differentiation, plasticity, memory, and learning. And you can see here, just activating muscles can release different mediators like interleukin-6 and BDNF and different decorin protein pathways. And these things can modulate adrenal gland activity. GLP-1, which is used to control appetite for the hypothalamus-gut interaction. Things like angiogenin that can modulate insulin release. And things like IGF-1 that impacts bone resorption. Muscle mass and muscle activity make a huge impact on endocrine function. So if you get like an underweight patient with no muscles, now you get hypoglycemia, now you add veganism on top, now you add lack of fat in the diet, now you look at protein malnutrition, they're going, which Chinese herb protocol do I take? You go, none. There's no chance with any kind of nutraceutical protocol. We've got to change these body composition factors. Now, an interesting thing that we know about is when you look at insulin resistance and obesity patterns and BMI, men and women that have increased, if they have obesity but they have increased muscle mass, they don't have the really abnormal lab work you would see with lipid panels and blood pressure that it has this protective effect. So if you take an obese male without muscles, their HbA1c, their LDL, their blood pressure, their CRP, their ferritin levels, they're all going to be really high. If you take that same amount of body fat but have muscle mass levels that are higher in that same group, you would see all those risks reduced. So myokine activity has a tremendous impact on protection and has a tremendous impact on endocrine regulation and function too. So you definitely want to have your patients have their muscle mass improved. Now, another key factor with lifestyle that's related to hormones is stress resiliency. We all have stress, but not everyone falls apart with stress. When someone has stress and there's no change in symptoms or functions, that means they have good high stress resiliency. They're able to adapt to stressors. If someone has an exposure to stress, there's a change in symptoms or functions that have reduced stress resiliency, unable to adapt to stress. One of the things you want to evaluate in your patients with any kind of endocrine disorder is how do they adapt to stress? And impaired stress responses means they have sleep disturbances under stress. Like someone can have a phone call with a friend, get in a little argument, and not sleep for the next 3 days. And someone else doesn't. So things like depression, anxiety, and rage are under stress, weight gain and weight loss are under stress, changing their gut function, like some people can have bowel urgency or constipation under stress, promotion of dysglycemia, some people could have severe blood sugar shifts and crave sugar when they're in stress. Those are all signs of impaired stress resiliency, right? Or they get really weak immune system, catch a cold when they're under stress. So the more impaired their stress resiliency is, the less ability they have to modulate their own hormones. And the more prone to get into a stress response physiology, which can disrupt both male and endocrine functions. So a scale of stress resiliency response is poor sleep quality to severe, like unable to sleep, really severe stress resiliency issues, weight gain or weight loss when they're under stress, intestinal permeability issues. And when we look at stress resiliency, when you look at, for example, this scenario here, lots of stress, no physiological response to stress, that's high stress resiliency. A little amount of stress, they have a physiological response to a little amount of stress, that's very low stress resiliency. And then you have physiological stress responses here with some stress, low stress resiliency. And then here you have lots, some degree of stress, some stress response, you have moderate stress resiliency. You have to look at your patient, see what their stress resiliency is. You can even ask them a question. You can actually show them this chart. If their stress resiliency pathways are off, you really want to focus on this pathway. Because when a person goes into what's called an abnormal stress response, and their cortisol and their epinephrine go up, and not everyone has it. So some people have very good degrees of stress resiliency. Some people could work two jobs, have a divorce happening, have lots of things in their life, and their cortisol and adrenal function is totally normal. They have a high degree of resiliency. Other people can't handle anything. They get into a little bit of emotional arguments, or they get a little bit of overtraining, and they just completely fall apart. When a person has their stress response activated based on the degree of their resiliency, you can have several things happen with their hormonal patterns that you have to be aware of. So it's not just the stress, it's the stress in combination with their degree of resiliency, because stress is going to impact people differently based on their degree of resiliency. If you have someone who's got loss of stress resiliency, and you have stressors like lack of sleep, overtraining, emotional overload, dysglycemia, inflammatory load, infection, these can lead to a physiological stress response. A physiological stress response basically means activating the stress hormone pathways, which are the adrenal pathways. ACTH goes up. Cortisol can go up or down. Epinephrine, norepinephrine go up. IL-6 goes up. And these directly impact the pituitary. In males and females, they suppress LH. That causes low progesterone in females, low testosterone in males. It can suppress FSH in both males and females, low sperm function, infertility in males, low estrogen function in females. This can lead to things like menstrual migraines. Lack of estrogens can be a devastating issue for females. Suppressed TSH levels can lead to a low T4 output, like a pituitary hypofunction. It can impact T4 to T3 conversion, so it can be a major issue. And also, you have to be aware that perimenopause, that transition from perimenopause to menopause, puts demands on the adrenal glands, and now their stress resiliency goes down. So as they go into this perimenopausal transition, now their cortisol levels change, testosterone levels change, they get electrolyte imbalance, they get hypoglycemic reactions. So the stress resiliency can be promoted by this adrenal demand that's put on them with perimenopause, because the adrenal glands are there to compensate for it. So these are another known mechanism, and we'll talk about this mechanism more when we get into the perimenopause web. So as a clinician, when you look at hormone imbalances, you got to know that the stress physiology pathways can be a factor. It's all dependent upon stress resiliency. Now, stress resiliency is corrected by three main things: sleep, exercise, and blood sugar stability. Those are the key things. As soon as you see failure of stress resiliency, these are the things you want to look for. You can't expect changes in stress resiliency until someone has movement, has sleep, and has their blood sugar stabilized. And obviously, you can use nutraceuticals like adaptogens to support this pathway, but you have to use them in combination with these strategies for lifestyle. Key concept. Non-adapted stress responses occur when individuals lose stress resiliency. Non-adaptive stress responses can lead to dysglycemia and hormone imbalances. And regular exercise, adequate sleep, and blood sugar glucose stability are the most important lifestyle strategies to improve physiological resiliency to stress responses. Because don't put a patient on 100 adrenal supplements for 6 months trying to fix their adrenal profiles if you don't have the resiliency fixed. You have to go with the fundamentals. Movement, like some kind of exercise, make sure they can sleep, and make sure the blood sugars are stable. Okay? Now, let's get into sleep. Another key thing you have to be aware about unrelated to resiliency is that sleep will throw off all hormones. And there's lots of studies here in your clinical notes, I won't go through all of them with you, but sleep disturbances have been shown to throw off rhythms, they cause depression, they cause hormone imbalances, they change cardiovascular markers, they increase blood pressure, they change lipid profiles, they lower testosterone, they lower growth hormone, they promote insulin resistance, they increase cortisol levels. So sleep is a major issue. This is a study that was published on men's sleep testosterone, cortisol balance in aging men, and basically this showed clear relationships between sleep restriction dropping testosterone levels in males. This was a systematic review of 13 studies, and they showed very clear epidemiological studies that women experience more sleep problems and depressed symptoms around times of sexual hormone changes as puberty and menopause. As their hormone levels fluctuate, it has impacts on their sleep functions as well. The key concept is adequate sleep is critical for normal cortisol, melatonin, circadian rhythms, proper function of the hypothalamus pituitary gland axis, and the hypothalamus pituitary ovarian axis, which is then involved with FSH, LH outputs for testosterone, progesterone, estrogen, and so forth. Hormone dysregulation and sufficient sleep are key factors. Now, sometimes people need hormones to sleep. We'll talk about that in a second here, especially in perimenopause. They can't fall asleep until they start taking some hormones. But in many cases, you got to go into the underlying factors that are involved. Now, this was a study of 13 studies that looked at sleep issues, and they found progesterone levels that are low or estrogen levels that were low can have an issue with sleep. And they also found the oral contraceptives cause sleep problems and depression. So although hormones can help when they're normal, actually taking oral contraceptives had a significant negative effect on sleep and promoted depression. So once again, this is really the right thing we need to do. So you'll see a bunch of these papers here related to adequate sleep and hormone imbalances. And then I put some notes together for you, like difference between ability to fall asleep, stay asleep, some slides here on things to do for sleep hygiene, and then some of the mechanisms involved with inability to fall asleep, clinical strategies to support falling asleep, like having someone do activity and burn off their catecholamines throughout the day, try to reduce their stress response at night, try to reduce overstimulating activities. Sometimes they need to take supplements that stimulate GABA pathways to help them fall asleep. Music therapy, less than 60 beats per minute, has been shown to help with sleep. If someone's on a ketogenic diet, sometimes they get into hypoketonemia. They'll need to take some exogenous ketones like MCT to sleep. One of the most common causes for people to wake up in the middle of the night is they get into a hypoglycemic state. They get into a nocturnal hypoglycemia that causes them to wake up. So they miss meals during the day. They don't get enough glycogen reserves. Since they don't have enough glycogen, they don't have enough fuel when they're in a sleep pattern to feed their brain. That causes their epinephrine, norepinephrine levels to go up, and then they wake up in the middle of the night. It's one of the most common causes for inability to fall asleep. It causes constant stress responses, loss of stress resiliency, and so forth. So some things that can help people get into deep restful sleep are weighted blankets. Weighted blankets help stimulate the serotonin dopamine levels, lower cortisol. That's been shown in some studies to help with people with anxiety, sleep. There's some pre and post results with them without using blankets to help with anxiety levels and sleep. Also some good studies on falling asleep with children and adults with ADD, ADHD that have a hyperactive mind to actually fall asleep. Music with rhythms less than 60 beats per minute This relaxation pathway has been shown to change serotonin, dopamine levels in the brain. White noise, especially people that just have tolerance to sounds that really impact their sleep, if they get a constant white noise machine, that's been shown to help them. This is like a machine where there's a little fan here. You push the button and this fan spins and it creates that white noise like an air conditioning sound. They're very good for some people. Mouth taping increases oxygenation to the brain. That helps people get into deep sleep as they get more blood flow to their brain. If you breathe through your nose, you get like 60% more oxygen to your brain. So when people use these tapes, you can buy these mouth tapes off Amazon or anywhere, and they have a little one-way valve so you can still breathe, but it makes you really breathe through your nose. And that's been shown to really help with sleep and deeper REM sleep. And then for some people that just, they can't sleep, you can try GABA nutraceutical supplements. That's really critical. Now, when it comes to sleep apnea, is by far the worst thing that can happen to endocrine function. So if someone actually has obstructive or central sleep apnea, it's going to completely devastate their endocrine function. And this is because it really promotes hypoxia and microbiome imbalances and inflammation. So key concept, men with andropause and obesity or women with PCOS and obesity should be checked for sleep apnea. It should be mandatory because you may not be able to untangle them until you get this corrected. And the clinical symptoms of sleep apnea, the most obvious one is they don't feel rested and recovered after they sleep. The morning irritability, the morning headaches, they drag around all morning, finally get enough stimulants in them to function during the day, and then they're like dragging. They want to take naps. Those are all the key signs of sleep apnea. Let me say this one more time. Sleep apnea will devastate the endocrine system. Devastate it. No chance. If you're trying to restore it normally, there's no nutrient, no supplement, nothing you can give them to counteract it. This has to be addressed. This is one of the problem habits in functional medicine, natural medicine. Such an immediate jump to trying to find the right supplement and avoidance of the serious pathophysiological mechanisms that totally disrupt the endocrine system. Sleep apnea, top of the list. Okay. Now, in perimenopause, you should also know that there's a lot of overlap symptoms of sleep apnea in perimenopause, like insomnia, night sweats, daytime sleepiness, poor concentration, memory loss. Sometimes the persistent perimenopause symptoms are really actually sleep apnea. So be aware of that. This is a study showing these relationships in the literature between sleep disturbances, PCOS, hormone imbalances, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular issues associated with it. This is a study that really goes, listen, with men that have hypogonadism and obesity, like one of the key issues is sleep apnea. This is one of the vicious, part of the vicious cycle. So is systemic inflammation, so is body fat. We'll talk about this andropause web a little bit more later, but you cannot overlook sleep apnea. Sleep apnea will promote inflammation, obesity, bone loss, throw off the pituitary, activate the stress response, and it could be an ongoing pattern of people unable to get out of their pathological patterns. So lots of studies you can review there with sleep apnea. And with sleep apnea, here you have a vicious cycle, sleep apnea, hormone imbalance, insulin resistance, obesity, PCOS, or andropause sleep apnea, and this is a major problem. And then they found like CPAP treatments, this was a study of 20 meta-analysis of 637 individual 22 studies. CPAP treatment in individuals with obstructive sleep apnea reduced cortisol levels and blood pressure. And then if you look at their outcomes with hormones, basically before CPAP machine testosterone was low, afterwards they stabilized, estrogen, progesterone were low, they stabilized, aldosterone was high, they stabilized or came down, insulin was high, they came down with after CPAP treatment. This is just within a few weeks. When people have this disrupted sleep apnea pattern, basically you get all types of hormone imbalances, hypoxia, dysfunction, you get neuroinflammation, and this vicious cycle that really leads to chronic persistent male and female hormone imbalances, inflammation, aromatization, obesity, FSHLH suppression. So you just have to screen for sleep apnea patterns. Then we get into diet, and with diet, it's pretty straightforward. You got to have protein and you got to have fat. When you look at hormones, there's two kinds of hormones. There's peptide hormones, which require protein, like FSH, TSH, LH. And you got to have protein intake of at least 0.36 grams to 1 pound of body weight. The best way to do it is just like half their pound of body weight in grams of protein. So if they weigh 150 pounds, make sure to cover with enough protein. They should have at least 75 grams of protein. So if they don't have enough peptides and amino acids, they can't produce hormones. They can't just binding hormones. Signs that someone's protein insufficient, they're not healing from injuries, they don't have muscle mass, muscle weakness, difficult recovery from exercise, hair loss, weak nails, and unhealthy skin. These are all signs of protein sufficiency. They're very, very common, especially in underweight individuals. And this is, for example, a 150-pound person with 75 grams of protein should be eating at least like something like this. If they're trying to gain muscle mass and function even better, then 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight would be ideal. So a 150-pound person should have at least like 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, especially if they're trying to actually function, recover, exercise, and do things. If they're not doing any kind of physical activity and totally sedentary, and they just want to make sure their endocrine system doesn't completely crash, then 75, if they weigh 150 pounds. If they're doing any kind of movement activity, physically active, want to have some function, they need to have 1 gram of protein per gram of body weight. And the studies have shown long-term insufficiency of like essential amino acids alters like endocrine function, thyroid axis activity. This is another paper introduction of major macronutrients, dietary proteins, a powerful determinant of longevity, health span, reproductive through both behavioral changes such as food intake as well as whole body cellular metabolism. The body has to have protein. This was a study we looked at postmenopausal women, 60 to 90. The protein intake was directly related to their performance and their function as they got older. Key concept, protein sufficiency should never be ignored in patients who are struggling with hormone insufficiencies. You should just think of 1 pound of body weight. Minimum amount is like 0.36 to 1, but just think of 1 pound of 1 gram of protein for every pound of body weight to get a really good sufficient dose. Dietary fat. The other hormones are fat. You have to have steroid hormones to make fat. If you have a person who's a fat phobic, who doesn't eat butter, doesn't have olive oil, doesn't eat any kind of fatty meats, they're not going to have a healthy endocrine function, healthy endocrine force productions of hormones. Plant sources could be fine. Animal sources could be fine. The key thing is with endocrine function, you need both unsaturated and saturated fat. You have to have some saturated fat. And when you look at hormones, you got to look at low-fat diets that devastate endocrine function. This was a study that was done, a 2-year randomized clinical trial with 220 subjects. They looked at the intervention of reducing total dietary fat to 15% of calories. 15% of calories is this patient. You want to hear it? This is the patient going, I eat a salad. I have skinless chicken. I don't like avocados. They're too fattening. I don't like oil. I don't like nuts and seeds. They're too fattening. I just use apple cider vinegar on my salad. And then I have a fruit smoothie. And they're basically eating no animal. They're eating no fat. They're not eating nuts. They're not eating seeds. They're not eating butter. They're not eating any kind of skin on chicken. That's very easy to get calories less than 50% of dietary fat. So in this study, they showed after 2 years on a low-fat carbohydrate diet, serum estradiol levels were 20% lower among premenopausal members of the intervention group, and progesterone was 35% lower. And here it is right here over this 2-year period of time. Intervention group, this is their estradiol levels. As soon as they start cutting their fat, boom, drops for the next 2 years. Control group, they don't drop their fats. Their estradiol levels are fine. Here's the progesterone levels. Intervention group, they cut their fats. Boom, levels drop for the next 2 years. And then you can see here, these are pretty stable. They come down a little bit there. But major effects on hormones. So you really want to make sure that person is eating fat, getting cholesterol in their diet. And then here's a paper that was published, 2-month study. Cholesterol levels were lowered by a low-fat diet, or significantly associated with estradiol, testosterone, and dehydrosteroidione levels dropping as well. So the basic concept is you have to have minimum dietary fat of at least 30%. Even a low-fat diet is sufficient to keep hormones intact. Here's the chart for you for like a Mediterranean diet is 35% 40 calories. That'll work. Ketogenic 75 to 80% calories. There's got to be at least 30% of calories from fat to maintain endocrine function. Key concept, dietary fat insufficiency should never be ignored in patients who are struggling with hormone insufficiencies. Minimal dietary fat should be at least 30% of total calories. Make sure your patients are eating healthy sources of both saturated and unsaturated fats. In addition to healthy saturated and unsaturated fats, patients must consume essential fatty acids and diverse fatty acids to optimize prostaglandin and their impact on hormone regulation. They have to have like all different sources of fats to maintain healthy endocrine function. Black currant seed oil, evening primrose oil, organ meats, nuts, seeds, or think of it differently. You need to have omega-3s, omega-9s, omega-6, arachidonic acid. Okay? These are critical. So you get the fat phobic person not eating fats, deficient in these fatty acid pathways, not getting enough calories, you got a problem. And the last one is blood sugar stability. And obviously, hypoglycemia or insulin resistance patterns. Hypoglycemia, blood sugar levels drop. Insulin resistance, blood sugar levels are high. I made a chart for you for symptoms of low blood sugar, high blood sugar. We'll go over these in detail a little bit later. But the most important clinical question to ask to determine a patient has an underlying blood sugar balance is, do you experience any change in your energy after function if you eat? And people that are hypoglycemic feel more energized. People that are insulin resistant feel less energized. And the three principles of stabilizing blood sugar levels are, number one, the patient must eat frequently enough to prevent drops of blood glucose. Number two, the patient must avoid insulin surges after meals. Number three, the patient must have enough glycogen to supply the body and brain with fuel throughout sleep. So we'll go over these in more detail in the next section. But in summary, when you look at all the dietary and lifestyle interventions, I made a chart for you that summarizes all these principles. I'm going to give you this chart and go through it with you in the evaluation part of it. When you think of this and you look at a patient, and for example, they have this endocrine disorder no one can fix, and they're taking handfuls of supplements, and oh my God, they're drinking plastics all day. The nonstop exposure to BPA and plastics. They have no physical activity. They're totally underweight. They don't eat enough protein. They don't have enough fat. They have any diversity of prostaglandins. Guys, there is no nutraceutical botanical game to play. It's not going to work. And some of those people that take hormones, they feel worse. They can't even handle them. It doesn't work for their system. You can't avoid these endocrine, dietary, lifestyle factors.
You can find all of this information and more at drknews.com/podcast. There you'll find the show notes, readings, and links related to this episode. You can also find Dr. Karazian's blog at drknews.com. The best thing to do is sign up for his weekly newsletter, where he will update you on the latest research and clinical strategies related to chronic and autoimmune health conditions. On social, you can find him on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest with the username Datis Karazian. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional health care services, including the giving of medical advice. And note, no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to the podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not delay or disregard obtaining medical advice for any medical conditions they have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. To learn more about Dr. Karazian's disclosures and the companies he advises, please visit drknews.com/about.